This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. On September 20th, the group Advocates for a Sustainable Albemarle Population held a panel discussion entitled Property Rights and Wrongs, Implications for Managing Local Growth. The session is moderated by ASAP President Jack Marshall.
My name is Jack Marshall. I'm the president of Advocates for a Sustainable Albemarle Population, ASAP, the outfit that is putting tonight's forum on. This is one of our regular monthly meetings. We are now meeting the third Wednesday of every month. Next month, October 18th, October 18th is the third Wednesday. Our meeting will focus on what I hope you've read about in the paper, ASAP's new initiative to ask the Albemarle County government to identify a sustainable, optimal population size. ASAP's argument is that we're growing at an unsustainable pace and are soon reaching, or have reached in the view of some, a population that is changing the quality of life and threatening our local environment. And that a smart community doesn't keep growing until it stops because an important resource disappears, or because we're so unattractive that folks don't want to come here and those of us who are here leave. ASAP's argument is surely we can stop before that. We can identify a tipping point that is a size of our community at which the costs start to exceed the benefits of growth and start to level off at that point. That's ASAP's argument. It has been for the 4 years we have been in existence. And the comprehensive plan is simply a first step toward that direction. It doesn't say stop. It says, let's get together as a community and identify what that population size, that optimal, sustainable population size is. Because right now, there is a limit on growth in the county. And people say, oh, you can't stop growth. The fact is, our zoning determines how many residential, as well as industrial and commercial, units can be built on every single parcel of land in the county. And if someone were to tally up the cumulative number of residential units that zoning allows, we would have the theoretical build-out for the county. Our hunch is that that number is up there and that it was determined without much thought by decision makers a quarter of a century ago who were concerned with zoning and didn't really think about the implications of it, and that our values and preferences today may not be the same. It may well be, today, that's not what we want. So we're asking, at this point, a fairly simple thing. What do we want? We think that no smart community can build to what it wants to be without thinking about population size. How do we do it with schools and roads and water and we anticipate, but not with growth. Oh, we can't do that. ASAP argues that we can and should. And the first step is to identify this optimal, sustainable size. And then, of course, to compare it with the build-out. What's the difference? And then, if there is a difference, we start saying, ah, what does that imply for us in terms of public policy? So our request for a comp plan amendment is fairly simple. Isn't what the headlines in the paper said, I don't have that one, I've got the wrong paper. But it said something about group wants to stop growth. That isn't what our comprehensive plan amendment says. It says our comp plan amendment says, let's just ask what we want. Now, I tell you all that because this is the focus of our next meeting, October 18th, and we hope you'll come here then too, because we're going to be asking questions about the practicality of identifying such a number, the ethics of doing it or not doing it, the political feasibility, and I think it'll be an interesting session. But tonight's session is going to be wonderful. I'm delighted with the three speakers we've got. As you know, there have been, in the last 2 weeks, a lot of attention given to efforts to control growth through smart growth methods. Smart growth isn't, we believe that smart growth is essential. Smart, but you know, not enough. It's necessary, but not, it's sufficient. I'm sorry, it's necessary, but not sufficient. In the last few weeks, there's been a focus in the county looking at three particular mechanisms for smart growth, that is, controlling where growth occurs and how it occurs, not whether. Don't ask that. Oh, we don't ask whether growth should occur. And these smart growth mechanisms have been the mountain overlay district that might constrain where it to be enacted, where houses could go on mountaintops and mountainsides, phasing, which would determine where it to be alive, it's dead, how many parcels in a large plot could be developed each year. The logic being that if you can't do all your available plots, chunk of land, in one fell swoop, then maybe the big developers from out of town might be less interested, and that would slow growth. Ultimately, presumably, you could develop them all, but not all in 1 year. And the third is clustering, the argument that to protect open space, rather than build wherever you want, if you've got, say, 15 units by law to develop on your land, you should, in the rural areas, cluster them together, leaving open space around. Well, the discussion about that, tended all to focus on property rights. And if you were at the meetings, they were lively and hostile. My wife was with me, and she said, I'm intimidated. There were cries, very hostile comments about you're taking my property rights. All of these mechanisms reduce my ability to do what I want with my land. Well, property rights it's the very, one of the main issues of what ASAP is thinking about. Our argument is that we have to ultimately reduce the development potential in Albemarle County. And if we don't, then that maximum, whatever that is, theoretical build-out will be achieved, and that may well be much too high. But to reduce the development potential, we have to do something about property rights. We have to reduce probably the number of property rights, either voluntarily or involuntarily. And that gets at the heart of tonight's discussion. The question we're going to be asking is, to what extent are arguments about property rights relevant to our local discussions about managing growth? Not whether they are or not, they certainly are. To what extent? How do they bear? How do property rights issues bear on growth issues? Jeremy Borden, I want to welcome particularly our new Daily Progress reporter, taking over for Jessica Kitchen. And I'm delighted, Jeremy, that you're here with us tonight. We couldn't have a better set of panelists who I think represent a wide range of issues and interests and backgrounds. John Cannon is in the middle, one of the reasonably new Albemarle County Planning Commissioners. How long has it been, John?
6 months.
6 months. Seems like 6 months, okay.
6 months, it seems about right.
when he's not commissioning, he is UVA Law School professor and director of the UVA Center for Environmental and Land Use Law. Blake Hurt, on the far end, is president of Capital Real Estate and the developer of Republic Plaza, a member of Albemarle County's Industrial Development Authority. And one of our links is that my wife is a potter, and Blake is a wonderful graphic artist. Sitting to my immediate left is Rich Collins, who is a founder and board member of ASAP, and a professor emeritus of urban and environmental planning and founder of the Institute for Environmental Negotiations in the School of Architecture at UVA. I am delighted, gentlemen, and grateful to you for all participating. Do we have you talked about a about who should go first? Do you have any ideas?
We did talk about it.
We did. And I think I'm going first.
Okay. Right. And who will go second?
I wasn't included in the discussion, so.
All night, Blake is going to be playing this role of the oppressed and despised minority.
I called it up. I guess I didn't mention it.
Blake, when would you like to
Well,
go?
2, 3, whatever.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm starting not because I have any advantage over either of my colleagues, but at least in my discussion with Rich, the thought was that I would do some stage setting here that would lay the basis for some of the observations that you will hear later from Rich and from Blake. I'm going to talk about the law of property generally, and provide a common base of knowledge, hopefully, for those of you who aren't lawyers and aren't intimately familiar with these concepts, so that what is said after I'm through makes more sense. I want to distinguish at the outset between two groups of property rights issues, both of which I think are relevant here. One, the legal issues, which I'm going to spend most of the time on. Two, the cultural issues, which are related to the legal issues but separate from them. And we may see notions of property rights that are prevalent in the culture that people understand and believe that aren't legally enforceable or defined in legal terms. And I think that's part of what we have in the debates and part of the misunderstandings that occur in debates on land use issues. So let me talk about property rights in the legal sense first. In law, at least at the level of the U.S. Constitution, property rights and debates about property rights center on the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, and particularly the Takings Clause. And the Takings Clause prohibits the taking of private property for public use without just compensation. That's basically verbatim what it says, and that's all it says. It is applicable to state and local governments. So if Albemarle County takes the property of someone who lives in Albemarle County, that action can be held to account under the Fifth Amendment, and the county can be required to either pay compensation or rescind the regulation. The Fifth Amendment doesn't define property, and it doesn't define a taking. So that leaves a lot of room for the courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, to get in the business of figuring out what is intended by this provision. And I'm gonna look at both of these terms in some detail here so you get a sense of what the court has decided. And I'm going to look first at what it means for property to be taken. What is it? What action by the government is it that would constitute a taking? And there are really two types of actions that are relevant for our purposes. One is a physical appropriation of property. The government comes onto your land and occupies your land so that you no longer can occupy it or exercise the right to exclude, which are thought to be very important property rights. The other form of taking, which is more relevant to our concerns here, is a regulatory taking. That is, the Supreme Court has held that even where the government doesn't physically occupy your land, even where the government lets you continue to live on the land, to exclude others from coming on your land, it may still affect a taking by limiting the uses to which you can put your land through regulation. And the question, as the court has defined it here, is whether the regulation of land is so burdensome as to be unfair. That is, whether the regulation imposes a burden that can't fairly be expected to be borne by the landowner without some kind of compensation, without just compensation. Now, the Supreme Court has two ways of determining whether, or two rules for determining whether a burden imposed by a regulation is unfair and therefore a taking. The first rule is, I will use the legal term, a per se rule. Okay? And that's a bright line rule that the court laid down in a case called Lucas v. South Carolina Coastal Commission. And in that case, the court said, in no uncertain terms, if a regulation extinguishes all economic use of a property, it is a taking. End of inquiry. It can be a valid regulation. It can be a regulation adopted in the public interest. But if it extinguishes all economic use of your property, it's a taking, and the government must pay compensation. All right, I'm going to come to that. Yeah. I mean, Rich is helping me. There is one caveat to that we'll come back to. But I'm trying to make the bright line rule really bright. There is also a fuzzy rule which the court applies in cases where there is not a total extinction of the value of the property resulting from the regulation. In cases where there is a substantial reduction in property value from the regulation, but not a total distinction, the court applies a fuzzy rule, an all-factors test, which is sensitive to the particular factual circumstances of the case. And that test considers things like the economic impact on the landowner and the interference with the landowner's investment-backed expectations. And that test was set forth in the case called Penn Central Transportation Company v. City of New York. Now, as I mentioned, the Penn Central test can be applied to find a taking where the regulation has not extinguished all economic use of a property, but where it has significantly reduced the value of that property. Now, I want to give you some sense of how these tests are applied and the results that they typically reach. Under either of these tests, it is not often that courts presented with takings claims find that takings have occurred. Right? It's not that they never find takings, but it is more likely than not, in response to any takings claim based on the statistics of the cases, that the court will find no taking has occurred. You have to make a very strong case if you're a landowner to get a court to hold under these rules that I've laid out that a takings has occurred, so that there is a wide range, just as a matter of law, there's a wide range of restrictions that local jurisdictions and states can apply to land that limit their use, that don't violate the takings clause, and therefore don't require compensation. So that was all about what's a taking. It's also important to know or to think about what's property. That is, for the Fifth Amendment to become applicable, there has to be a taking of property. And if what's being taken is not property, if the owner, landowner, doesn't have that among his or her property rights, then there's no taking. What the Supreme Court has said about property is that it's defined through state law, what the Supreme Court calls the background principles of state property law. Okay? And those are unique to every state. But just to give you an example, a kind of a negative example, to give you an idea of how this works, under most state law, virtually all state law, there is recognition of nuisance. That is, landowners are prohibited from maintaining uses on their property that substantially interfere with the use and enjoyment of their neighbor's land. Okay? So, under most state law, virtually all state law, as far as I know, property owners' rights, the property owned by a landowner does not include the right to maintain a nuisance. So, a regulation can be imposed that prohibits absolutely nuisance-type activities on land. And that is not a taking, even if it extinguishes all use of property, because it's not a taking of property. It's not the taking of a right that the landowner has to use that property. Now, what is significant about this, and more broadly about the court's recognition of the background principles of state law as defining property? What the court has indicated, it's not clear exactly what this means, but what the court has indicated in Lucas is that over time, these background principles of state law defining what property is can change. They can evolve. So that certain rights that a landowner may have or be able to claim today, a landowner may not have or be able to claim in the future, depending on the evolution of state law. So, for example, nuisance doctrine could change so that more things or different things are considered nuisance in the future than are today. Or other principles of state law could be established that over time become the background principles of state law defining property. So there's room for change in the law as the court has defined it. And that's important for my next point, because I want to move from the law right now to culture briefly, and hopefully this will help set up the discussion with the other participants. Law is an expression of culture, but it's not a full expression of culture. So what I've given you are some legal rules, but they are much narrower and more fixed and stable than the range of views that exist within the culture about what property rights are. And I'm going to just very crudely here sketch out two contrary views of what property rights are or should be, to give you my sense of the range of this, and then to give you a sense of how the law might evolve, since we've already said that there is room for the law to grow or change in this area. The first group, at one poll you might say, is that property rights are absolute. That is, a landowner has the right not only to exclude others, but also to use the property for any purpose to which he or she might put it, save perhaps as a nuisance. So that property owners essentially should be compensated for any diminution in value that would be occasioned by a regulation. And that's a view I'm not a libertarian myself, and I don't want to misrepresent views of libertarians, but scholars associated with the libertarian position take that view. They argue that view, that's the way it should be. There should be an absolute protection of property rights in that sense, subject only to just compensation if those rights are interfered with. The second view is that property rights should be much more qualified than they are now. And that is a view that proceeds from the idea, I think, that we live in a very interdependent world. Ecological science has taught us to think of the landscape as a highly interconnected system, and to think of each plot of land not as a self-contained entity, but as part of a larger system, such that virtually any use, the extreme expression of this, virtually any use of that property has effects on property elsewhere in the system. So according to that view, we need a more limited or restricted view of the prerogatives of ownership in order to reflect this knowledge. Those are the two poles. There is active dialogue between them. Active might be an understatement. My own view, and this is where I stop being neutral and kind of tip my hand, but I don't think it's inappropriate at this point. My own view is that as we experience greater congestion and systemic failures, like sprawl in the Washington suburbs and maybe moving to Albemarle County, maybe it's already here, or at the global level, global climate change, the sense of property as a qualified right will grow. That is, we'll have a greater sense of our interrelationship and therefore a greater tendency to define our ownership both as rights and as mutual or reciprocal obligations in a way that, that limits what we independently may choose to do with our property. And, you know, if I'm right, then over time, that change will be reflected in state law and will become reflected in the law of property as applied by the Supreme Court. But the change is gradual. Change of this kind is very gradual. It's incremental. So I wouldn't expect something radical or sudden to happen. And I think while it's going on, it's important not to forget the contributions that ownership makes to good stewardship of the land. I mean, the folks at the hearing that Jack talked about, some of the landowners were very angry, but one of their claims was, and it's a legitimate claim in many cases, that they have taken good care of their land and would continue to do so. Some of those folks had even donated easements on their land in order to protect their land in perpetuity. So that there is a sense in which property can contribute to good stewardship as well as, in some cases, perhaps be an impediment. And I think we need to be sensitive to that as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Blake, have you a preference going next? Or
Rick, what did you decide?
I think you should go next.
I need to apologize. I think this is probably the only time I'm really going to be the left, Rich, position. And I think, I guess my apology stems from the fact that I'm not going to play, I think, the preordained role of the wild-eyed, rabid developer. At least in my own mind, maybe by the time I finish, I'll recast me into that role. So let me really summarize some of the things. First, let me dispose of what I think is the straw man in this, which is I don't think this is really an argument about people having unfettered right to do with their property that they'd like to do. Just as I don't think people have the unfettered right to drive their car any way they see fit. I think, in general, if you have property, you have an obligation to the community, and the idea that whatever you want to do is satisfactory is incorrect. There's always been limits on what you can do with your property, and I think those limits are becoming restricted in cases where the community becomes larger, more concentrated. I think what this debate really is about is if you change the existing rights of people, that is, what is the pace that you're going to circumscribe the rights that people have come to expect on something that they bought, and how rapidly do you change those rights, and what do you do as you change them? And I think that is really the tough problem. So I'm going to organize my thoughts really along giving you a few principles of how I think about it. I'll give you a couple techniques in order to evaluate the situations that come up. Some examples of the situations that I think people are going to run into in this community and others, and maybe a suggestion or two about how someone should proceed if they want to influence land use policy. A few principles are, first, that the regulation of land use should be clear and uniformly applied, and that the laws are not to be interpreted differently for similar circumstances. So, for example, significant delays in approval, in my mind, are equivalent to denial of approval. You can say, this is our rule, but gee, we can't get to you for 2 or 3 years. And so I don't think that's a clear rule. If they want to say any application will automatically be delayed 3 years, that's the rule. But to say that you'll promptly address the applicant and then don't, I think is unfair. Second leads me to this next point, which is that regulation should be fair. And what that means in my mind is if the shoe was on the other foot, would it feel as comfortable to you? So, for example, I don't believe this area should be a country club for the well-to-do. I don't think discriminating against the community, the less well-off in the community, is something we should encourage. I think we should try to avoid it. I think we should try to avoid discriminating against people who come to this area who weren't born here. And many of you probably were, I guess. I think the use of restrictive growth policies to prevent new populations from the area rather than good planning to ensure an attractive community is often as the consequence of pushing the economically disadvantaged into distant or inadequate housing. That meaning that the idea that somehow if we stop the number of buildings, somehow that will stop the number of people. Well, it will stop the number of people, but what it will oftentimes do is change the people in the house. So that if you have a house that you've lived in, and you find that it's tripled in value, and your taxes have tripled along with it, you might find it difficult to stay in that house and be very tempted to sell out to someone who moves down from Washington or California who's willing to pay you triple what you thought it was worth. The disadvantage is that now you might have to live in an adjacent county. So the idea of just stopping how many houses are built isn't the same idea as preserving the community. And in fact, it might have the consequence of radically changing the community. And you can see that, if, for example, if you look around the university and see neighborhoods that were generally economically disadvantaged and have come gentrified to such an extent that those living there can no longer afford to. And in fact, can't find affordable housing near the university, which is where they might work. So I think that we should avoid the idea that we're going to have some policy that's going to put the disadvantaged at a worse advantage. Another principle is that I think the regulations should be harmonious that we have with adjacent communities. That is, if Albemarle and the city of Charlottesville's problems are addressed in a radical way, and they're not addressed in a similar way in Nelson or Orange or Buckingham, what you have is a disparity that puts us out of step and can result in, for example, the people having who can't afford to live in Albemarle having to drive quite a long ways to get to the place that they can live. Finally, I think the physical structure of a community is influenced by land use laws, and that the changes in them can have complex and unintended consequences. So, for example, I remember 25 years ago, this idea of we need to make lots more difficult to get, because that will stop people from coming to the area. And the idea was increase the rural lot size to 21 acres, because then they'd have to buy, instead of 1 acre, 21 of those, and it would be much more expensive. Well, at first it seemed to work, that people found it much more expensive to buy that. But really what happened was that it didn't stop the number of lots from being created. It just increased the price of the lots, and it acted as basically a shotgun of housing across the county. So the idea of clustering was killed off by the initial attempt of the people against growth by slowing it down by making these lots so much bigger, without thinking about the unintended consequences that would if they bought the same number of lots, but they're all bigger now. So you have to, if you're going to change land use, you need to think about it very carefully before you do it, because it may have changes that are not exactly what you expected. And that leads me to a point that John's already made, which is I think these regulations have to change slowly. And that there's a tradition in the community of what people expect, and that you need to give those traditions and the people who believe in them some time to adapt to these ideas of changing land use. I would like to move on to a couple of techniques, at least that I think about when trying to evaluate changes in land use. The first is this fellow John Rawls's kind of curtain of ignorance, which is if rather than think of a situation and come up with a law that will fix it, think about the law as being applied to a situation where the time, place, and actors are hidden from you. That is, you think about what that rule would be as many different situations and see, does it cut the same way that you intended it to? For example, on the 21-acre lots. Yes, the idea was too many houses are being built in rural areas. The quick fix was make the lots bigger and thus more expensive. The result was it didn't do that. What it did was put all the rich people who could afford that way out of town, causing a lot more congestion, decreasing community, and hurting neighborhoods. So first, think about that. If you were on the other side of that curtain, didn't know who the actors were, would it always work that way? And I'll give you some other examples. So the second point is, if faced with a situation which you obviously agree, say the purpose of ASAP here, use what I think of as Robert Rubin's, the former Secretary of Treasury technique, which is the out-of-circle critic. He would, faced with a difficult policy decision, have to try to come up with what a solution was, and usually there was one that was evident. And what he would do is, in his circle, he would pick one person. He'd say, your job is to be the advocate against it, to come up with something that doesn't work, to make us work through why we should adopt this, what looks like self-evident policy, and try to work through it. And in general, what happens is, if you make that decision after a fair amount of discussion, you end up with a better result, rather than all rushing to the same side of the boat, as sometimes is the case. The third principle is one from what I think Isaiah Berlin called the value pluralism, which is that there is no silver bullet, that you can have a set of equally valid values of what you want for the community, and there is no objective way to obtain them all. So you could have, I want a pleasant community, I like it the way it is, I want to have poor for the housing, and you may find there is no policy that does all those things. And if you recognize that when you have these things, then you have to realize that over time, the ordering of those values will change. And if you make a policy that orders them in a certain way, that you've deprived those people who have a different opinion and an equally valid way of reordering them, the right to enjoy them. So you should make policies carefully, because some of those values, which cannot be compared, are going to be reordered in the future, as they have been reordered in the past. And finally, I think that in the principal technique is that you should respect tradition. That there are a lot of people who have thought about how the community should be, have tried to structure it in a way that's improving it. And to rapidly try to change those things, oftentimes, is to overlook the experience that has gone before you. And so, again, because land use is dear to many people in their hearts, I think that you should look at what has happened in the past. For example, I remember a discussion of the Planning Commission when we were thinking about putting a sewer line a long ways away to a new community. The discussion was, let's undersize the line. And the reason we'll undersize the line is that although the service authority thinks that it should be accommodate future development, if we keep it small, they can't do it in the future. So somehow let's staple the future generation's shoe to the floor so they can't walk in that direction. Well, it didn't work that way. And so they did do that, and then they had to put in another sewer, because, in fact, there were other issues in subsequent time that resulted in the community growing. Let me give you some examples. So you've got a number of policies, and you've got a couple of situations. So the first is, whether the government should be able to deny a developer the properly zoned right to build on 29 big box commercial center. And you think, okay, well, yeah, I think they should be able to do that. And then the other question is, well, should the government be able to downzone for example, economically impoverished neighborhood and reduce the value of all those homes in that area in order to preserve its architectural feeling? So you want to preserve the pastoral setting in one and stop that rich developer from making any money. In the other case, you end up taking people who have waited a lifetime to see their house finally appreciate, and you slice their value in half and make their retirement much more difficult. The second situation is whether the government can override the objections of property owners to build a reservoir for the benefit of the area and substantially reduce the value of the property for the downzoning. And if you look out west of town, when they put the reservoir in there, all the people in the watershed lost value of the property until they can't build there because it would affect the watershed. It seems like a reasonable thing to do. Then the question becomes, well, should the government be able to override the objections of property owners to install a bypass for the benefit of the area and substantially reduce the value of people close to the bypass? Well, if you had asked many of those people in this area, they'd be dead against the bypass because, it cuts through the pastoral setting. But if you asked the people in Lynchburg, they wouldn't quite feel the same way. And if the argument is you're going to have government have rights to preserve the area, when do you draw the line? Does the line stop at Albemarle County so we don't have to help Lynchburg? Or not? Third set would be, can the government condemn the entire neighborhood in order to build a large commercial complex for the purpose of invigorating the local economy? And they did this when they built Vinegary Hill. They basically told all those black people in their neighborhood that they lived in slums, and they took them and built a new hotel. And they wanted to see downtown improve, and I think they feel maybe they were right. The opposite question is, well, if they have that right, should they have the right to go ahead and prohibit large acreage development for the purpose of restraining the economy? Well, if you believe that they should be able to restrain the economy because we like it the way it is, should they have been able to go ahead and take down all of Vinegar Hill and throw those people out? And if you don't, do you still agree with the principles that you need to be fair? We're in the shoe on one side, one foot or the other. Those are some of the questions. And I guess my suggestion is in doing this, and this is none of this is legal, and I'm not a professor at the university, but I think that, you know, an interesting place is not accurately described by the number of people there. I think you can have a difficult community with 200,000, as I think Jack would say. I think you can have a difficult community with 10, too. I think the interesting places are defined by the nature of the community and how they work together. So I would say that it would be a good idea to focus on how you improve the community, not on how you freeze it, because I don't think freezing really works. And I think that if you're going to make that change in policy, that you need to carefully consider the wisdom of advocating those policy changes because of the sweeping effect that they have, their enduring, and the possible indirect effect that they may have on other things, because I think the world is interconnected. And finally, I think that the community is diverse. And if you advocate policies that in a way restrict the diversity, for example, let's get rid of the poor people inadvertently, but nevertheless, you lead eventually to a community that's ossified. So I think that in general, it is a community process, and the way you move forward is you think of it as holding hands, and everybody holds hands, and the result is that as you try to move, it's very awkward to move forward as a group. But that process, I think, is important. And so I think if you think of it that way, one, it happens relatively slowly. It happens on the edges. It's not, according to one, there's no guy who leads you forward. It's the group decision and has to be moved forward and backwards. And the result, hopefully, is the community moves forward as a whole and not one guy or one group dominating the rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Blake. Very provocative as I knew it would be. 15 minutes, Rich?
Sure. First of all, I want to thank both of you for coming. As an ASAP member, it's a real privilege to have you guys come. I know that you've got many other things to do. And I'd like to first say that the members of my class that are here, I teach a course in preservation planning. And we thought originally this was going to be on a Thursday night, but it's a Wednesday night, and they're coming here as part of their class assignment. Thank and you. The reason I bring that up is because I was over at the law school.
I wondered how you got so many people to come.
Well, grab what you can, John. I don't know how many you get. Actually, it was accidental. It was not by design. And they and we may stay for a little longer, although your lectures are probably more than, you know, I don't want to compete later, so I don't mind. But anyway, my point is that I went over to the law school to do some work for our course. And as I was going up the stairs to the second floor research, I came across an art exhibition. And there were three paintings, or four, by Blake Hurt that really caught my eye. And I want to tell you that whatever his views are on property and growth and stagnation and all that, I wish I had his talent. It's an amazing, I think you call it ink collage.
That's right.
It's a photograph of some person with character, and he overlays it with software and of different types that add to the dimension of the underlying photograph so that you get different visual images as well as a strong emotional sense of what you're trying to accomplish. I wish I could do that. Anyway, congratulations. Now, I wish he would go into the law books and look a little bit more at some of the things that I think that we should be talking about here this evening. But, so thank you for coming, Blake. And anybody that quotes Isaiah Berlin and Robert Rubin and John Rawls, let's face it, we're in trouble. because I happen to have looked at all those sources as well. So we didn't pick an easy mark here. And thanks for coming. Now, I want to mention also with John Cannon, I want to say I've been here for a long time, and before John came, and I think we met soon after you came. And
we did.
Yes, and we started working together, and there were a lot of things we had in common, and I want to say that he made a huge difference in our law school. Before John came, if I went out to the law school to talk about a joint degree program with our people with planning and law degrees, and we have several of those, it was never easy to find anyone who had any real commitment or a kind of leadership in what we would call environmental and land use law. There was just no one there. He has transformed that. And again, I want to refer to an immediate event. He organized, along with some law school students a few months ago, the 25th anniversary, I believe, of the Environmental Law Journal. And he pulled together a conference. I want to refer to one of the people in that. That's why I'm talking about this. I've been on that editorial board for, I think, 25 years, too, I think. Anyway, the point is that what I would like to accomplish tonight, trying to figure out how far I should go in one direction, let's call it deep property, and I'm not a deep person myself, but I didn't think that would make sense. On the other hand, I didn't want to talk about the 21-acre thing either, although I'm prepared to do either. I want to tell you, I really do think that property is the most challenging and what I would say malleable and yet ideological concept that governs how we're going to deal with our future. That is how the concept of property interacts with the environment, nature, culture, community, and not just individual rights. It's going to determine whether we are going to avoid the worst consequences that many of us feel are imminent, not only in global warming, but in rapid and perpetual growth. So I don't want to make any bones about that. I have a strong emotional commitment to the ideas that ASAP represents, and I'm glad that we are not going to just argue this evening, but hopefully we can deliberate, and if I use my 15 minutes and no more, we'll have an opportunity to allow you to talk. But to go back, one of the persons he invited to that conference, and I attended that talk, was Eric Freifogel. Mm-hmm. Eric Freifogel is a professor of law, I believe in Indiana, mm-hmm. Illinois, one or the other. Yeah. And he has an article called The Culture of Owning. And I think that my views are so similar to his, I don't know whether I took them from him, I think not, or that great minds work in unison. But this article, I just wish everyone could read it, because you will see that what John wanted us to think about. Don't think just about the takings clause or Penn Central or the legal requirements, but understand that is embedded in a culture. And that culture includes not just culture, it includes politics, economics, gaming, local elections, financial operations. That it is a zoning land use game. And I don't use game in the sense that it's fun, but that it is to understand it, as I understand it, is that you have to put all of these together somehow to know what is really going on and how to interact effectively within it. So that's my view. But Eric Freifogel says, if I can find my glasses, one quote is...
Your glasses are right there.
Yeah, okay. Again, well, you see the... China. They come in from China. I'm in favor of globalization. They work for me because I think Chinese have small faces and these barely reach my ears. So I assume that's something cultural. Property cannot be defined sensibly by starting with the idea that it first and foremost is an individual right. I believe the title, and I think you chose the title, of how relevant are the arguments about property to the issues of our time. And I'm not opposed to argument. I'm an argumentative guy in many ways. But I do think that what we have here is not the concept of right, or that it's not important, that property is not important, but indeed they are. But they are no more important than the consequences of what we're trying to do. They're no more important concepts than that of the community good, or of ecological stability, or of a variety of others, including community cooperation. Those are all valid and important concepts. But what I find is not with Blake, and all my discussions are not necessarily directed to either of these two people, but to the forces and activities of the game that goes on out there, that all too often we're dragged into a draft of how they want to proceed, that property rights are first, they trump everything else, let's not talk about consequences, let's talk about the property right, and they define it as if it's, as John said earlier, the libertarians is a piece of property with fences around it. It's one thing. There's one owner, and this owner is aggrieved, and you can't change it because it's unfair to that person to alter the rules, no matter what the consequences, unless you compensate them, right, for that loss, the expectation, or if you unless you gain a consensus that they say, oh yes, I agree, the water will be polluted, the mountains will be devastated, whatever it is, right. And I will then allow you to regulate me. Those rules will not work. They have not worked. And we need to put more of an edge on this than I think either of the other two gentlemen on the panel with me apparently believe. So I understand that this discussion will go forward, and so I just wanted to be as direct as I could. Now, a second thing that I would like to say is this is a speech I found it getting ready for this session. It's entitled Blending Legal and Planning Imagination for Protecting Land in Virginia, a Spur to Discussion and Innovation. I gave this talk to all the boards of supervisor members who were down at the homestead for some meeting, and this is about 5 or 6 years ago. I can't find the date on the darn thing. But I wrote something there that I still believe, and I'm going to quote myself. In my view, too much legal imagination and energy is being devoted to trying to define the proper balance between the police power, which is the power to protect the public health and safety, and private property through litigation, and too little devoted to resolving the underlying concern through innovative planning processes. I believe that's still the case. We can debate till the cows come home and then some. And we will never find a consensus on exactly where the line should be drawn between government need to protect the environment, our culture, our welfare, and those who think that it should be they should be compensated if that is to be done. We're never going to find that line, and I think John has suggested, I won't put words in his mouth, but I think when he quoted what the fuzzy law, that fuzzy law has been placed since Penn Central, and it has not really been altered in 40 years. That same law that the Supreme Court announced in Penn Central is still the law that they will announce tomorrow on matters of the type that John has discussed. Now, if he disagrees with me, I hope he will not. I don't believe that I'm mistaken. But I'm saying that fuzzy line is the fuzzy life. That is fuzzy reality. Life is fuzzy. And that we ought to understand that there's no court, I don't care whether it's Alito and Thomas or whoever it is going to be able to define that line to the satisfaction of everybody in this country. But that law has been solid, it has worked well, except for those who believe that they want to repeal what the Supreme Court has stabilized for 40 or 50 years to go to, quote, some bright line that would take us back into the last century in terms of property law as announced by the court at that time. So I want to say that I want to move forward. I think characteristic of ASAP is, look, we're putting something out. We want to have deliberation. We'll have some arguments. We're going to have some strong disagreements. But we're inviting you to come. We want to look at the ethical side of it. Now, three things that I'd like to have you think about that I think will improve the process of deliberation and not just argument if we could agree to it. The first is that I would like you to do what every law first-year law student does, and that is if they don't begin to think of property as a thing or an object, they learn right away that they should think of property as a bundle of sticks. Right, John?
That's what they say.
Right. Okay. And I think that's what they do, generally. But yeah. Okay, but the idea of switching...
Which sticks?
Right, there we go. That's what Eric was talking about. Right. Okay, I'm trying to get the group here to think, at least when we talk about property and somebody says, you've just taken my property right, and we look at it as a bundle of sticks, your question should be, what stick did we take? What stick of the bundle of this abstraction of property did we take? Could you define it for me so we can define particularly what that stick means, what other sticks remain, how that stick has an important function that you think demands that we listen to your claim that your right trumps the concerns that we have about mountainsides or loss of open space or undue height in the middle of our city? That's the question. So I would say that if you would say property is a bundle of sticks, most of you are going to say that's a little different because we don't think of it that way. The usual way is to think of property as a thing, right, as opposed to the rules and rights and responsibilities that revolve around it. And the right that we're fighting about here in Charlottesville and Albemarle, and we will be fighting about, is likely the right to convert land from existing use or permissible uses, right, to a much higher intensive use for as long as there's a market that would support it. One stick out of many sticks. And the Supreme Court has been very definite about this. Whatever your culture is, you come to court, you're not going to win on that argument. That's only one stick, and we are very, very responsible in holding the law that as long as it stays in the boundaries of the per se rule and of reasonable due process, we are not going to tell a city, a county, a state, or the United States that they can't do it. So it falls on our
responsibility to define property in the cultural framework, which includes, as John has pointed out, an evolving sense of the relationships between air, water, land, and culture, and that we have to acknowledge it, and we can't wait 50 years to do it. There's a degree of urgency here that justifies, I believe, the emotion if I'm portraying it right now. I don't say that I'm right, but I believe that the motivation that I have is based on sound ideas and sound thinking, and I think many others feel the same way. So that's one thing. Think about it as a bundle of sticks rather than a thing, and you will be on the road to productive discussion that allows for a lot of play for ideas and innovation, and not simply, you know, plague on your house or plague on your house, which is all too often what happens. I'm going to divert to another subject, even though I have some ideas about the other thing. Secondly, I want to support what John has already said, that, and I'm quoting from Freifogel, a corollary of the right to hold property has been a duty to refrain from using it in a manner that would cause harm or injury to neighboring landowners or to the general public. He used the word nuisance. And there is a difference between nuisance and harm to the general public, which gets all confused in these general background principles, which he discussed. But that's fundamental law. That's fundamental to law going back to England in the 17th century. That is nothing new. There's nothing in the environmentalist that we're asking for that's strange, novel, radical, or deep. It's just the normal thing we're trying to work out, not something that we've cooked up here, or because we don't agree with capitalism or have some cockamamie idea that's far out of our cultural experience. Now, the question then is this. When we have to have a deal with a statute that is proposed, and John, I want to give him credit, worked very hard on both those ordinances to get a consensus. I'll let him talk about what that meant. But I've been involved in many of those kinds of consensus processes in my 25 years as mediator, so I'm not unfamiliar with the difficulties and the opportunities. But I guess you should ask yourself, when I think about the mountainside ordinance or a limitation on what someone can do next to their stream, or a wrecking ball that takes down the oldest piece of architectural quality in the city, are we preventing a harm? Or are we creating a benefit unfairly burdened by the diminution of some economic expectations of the owner of that property? Is it a harm or a benefit? Now, there's no way that you can find neutral ground on that, I understand. But it is the difference in the thinking about what are harms that the government can rightfully preclude by their authority, in fact, the necessity and the trust we put in them to protect our integrity and our culture, rather than, well, we're just stealing something from you, as the Free Enterprise Institute said in one of their recent documents. I'm trying to think of what's the name of them?
My group, is that what you're trying to
say? Yeah, your group. Here it is, right here.
John Birch, I think that's my group.
Well, here's their idea of a property rights argument. If you wish to control a piece of property, buy it. Oh, I love that kind of great clarity. The other is, here it is, the Free Enterprise Forum, and they are the people that are writing the master script that's going to go after everything that ASAP supposedly. There's just no question about it. They're working for this, as I call it, the master script. Property rights are the cornerstone of our freedom. Time-based division is wrong. Time-based division right is theft of property rights. Time-based division is illegal in the state of Virginia. Now, that's their view of what John and this committee tried to put together, and it's not at all what Blake has said. But I'm saying that, in a way, the public hearings and the processes of debate will include more of that kind of talk than discussion of Mr. Berlin's theories on social justice.
1 minute.
Okay. The third thing I would ask you to ask is that, I guess one that I've already said, is that I want you to think of the relationship about how people who live where maybe Blake lives, I don't know where they live, I'll leave that out. Those people who live in clustered communities or in gated communities, they have condominium or other kinds of rules. They have their own property rights system that by contract. And you can't park a truck in their driveway, and you can't paint your house green, and you can't bring bourbon to the swimming pool, or whatever those rules are. And they got very extensive rules, right? Once you get behind those gates, those people tie it down like nothing you've ever seen. Zoning and things we're trying to do is kind of the poor man's gated community. We just don't have the money to get in. No, and I'm not. I know it's. So I'm asking you to think about, in a way, the concept of property and creativity. That was my starting theme. Condominium was an idea that hardly anyone talked about. The property of condominium was a new concept that goes back around 30 years. The concept of conservation easement is an invention and a useful one that we now are using widely. The concept of timeshare, right, is another. So in other words, there is lots of room to innovate, to create, as well as to modify. And so I'm encouraging you to think and to participate in discussion, not necessarily to share my views on where it comes out, but to think beyond the normal kind of exchange of cannon shots, right? And tonight, I think, in my view, we've made a step in that direction, and I hope I haven't exceeded my time. Thank you.
Our custom here is to first let the speakers speak among themselves, ask questions of one another, if you wish, for maybe 5 minutes, even another 15 minutes or so. And then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. And our custom is to ask you to tell us who you are before you ask your question. Would any of you care to address any of the rest of you?
Yeah, I have a question. Pierre, would you go first if you feel appropriate?
No.
Dick Cheney asked me to ask this question.
Well, you don't have a shotgun in your hands, so no problem.
What would you say if you were on the city council and they came to you and said that they wanted to take down the Vinegar Hill neighborhood to put up the Ramada?
You mean as it once was, or mean right now today?
No, as it once was. Would you have been supportive of it or not?
I believe I probably would have been, yes. I'm putting myself in that situation because I agree with you if I understood the implication of the statement of urban renewal and the demolition and removal of all the mostly black residents of Charlottesville. That occurred before I moved to Charlottesville. Urban renewal proved to be a disaster for many of the black communities particularly, and it often serves as a boon to businessmen who were supporting it very enthusiastically. I'll ask you, do you think you would have been opposed to it back then? Or would you have voted with me saying, I think we need to do something about the conditions on Vinegar Hill and we need to be fair about it? What side would you vote on?
Well, I think it would have been a difficult question to answer.
Me too.
And I don't think I, in general, would have been against it. For example, the situation now is if they have an architectural review, they have a law that says no matter how old the house is, if it's over 100 years, you have to go before architectural review to look at it.
It's only 50 years, and you don't all have. Well, anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt. 50 years.
That's right. So if you're a house that's 50 years old, and suddenly it's under the government's auspices on whether you can change the paint color. And I think that, you know, maybe that's okay, but I'm not so sure that by virtue of age alone, although I believe anybody who's over 50 really should be.
Easy.
I don't think it goes to 60.
You're still getting personal.
I'm not so sure that the government should always have that right.
I believe the government, I think the most important thing that all of us said, I think, I didn't say this clearly, you did, fairness is a criteria that we have to work on. It's got to be fair, it's got to be perceived as fair, and we have to work very hard to define fairness and understand that we're not going to unanimity on fairness.
And is it always the case that you think that one stick, the right of you to use it as it is zoned, is always trumped by the desires of the community?
No. I, what I'm trying to say is that normally, if you allow me to use the word rhetoric in the classical sense, it is the ability to persuade other people by using words and terms and analogies and metaphors that are likely to get them to vote on your side rather than on their side. What I'm saying is that the common rhetorical technique, the master script for people who don't want growth management, who don't want zoning if they could get away from it, and who want to continue things pretty much as it's always been in their view, or should be, property rights, try to concentrate on that one thing, and they act as if we're taking all their property rights away. We're undermining Jefferson's idea. Their title is not safe. That when they talk property right, let's talk about what stick it is and how you think that particular stick is going to be, should be dealt with, as opposed to all the other sticks which are also in that bundle. That's all I was saying. And that's very common. When I've talked too much, but anyway, that's why I'm saying it. I think that the idea of thinking of a bundle of sticks is not because that's always the best metaphor, but it's one that opens up dialogue and discourse, and I believe useful deliberation, rather than you took my right, end of story, let's not talk about the rest of it, either pay me, get my agreement, or go home. And that's what happened.
That may be the rhetoric, but that's not ever the question. The question is can Chuck Rodkin put up a big box development on 29 North along a major highway when it's zoned correctly? Or how much does he have to pay for off-site improvements in order to persuade the Planning Commission to do that? So it's not a question of should Chuck use a stick. It's a question of, well, this is a community decision. And if the decision had already been made that it's zoned properly, and if he's following the rules, how much change should be allowed by the government to change the rules because they suddenly don't like, in fact, another big box development? And it seems to me, my position really is that by the time it's applied, it's really too late to change the rules on someone who has the expectation of what he bought the property for, he's worked towards, he's gone by the rules, and then to have it shifted underneath because some group decides that it's not fair for their particular bundle of sticks, I think is wrong. And furthermore, I think that if you're going to change the rules, you need to provide, for example, an overlay district for the mountaintops. If those people bought it...
That's what they're proposing, wasn't it? John, weren't you proposing an overlay district?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm saying that it has to happen slowly. That if someone bought their farm with the idea that they were going to do a development, there should be plenty of notice for him to make changes in his plants. It should not be something that is introduced in May, passed in November. I think it has to have a considerable amount of time to transpire to let those people who had the expectation that their few rights, and I'm not saying they can't be changed, are going to be abridged because people feel like they would like to have a clear view of the mountains.
I want to ask John to help mediate here. John, I don't want to get into the fight.
I'm happy to get into the fight. I want to try to shift the terms of the debate a little bit. First of all, fairness is always an issue here, and in my view, fairness is ultimately the issue that divides people. So I want to talk about that in a minute. There are mechanisms that try to promote fairness. For example, in response to Blake's example of the rules changing under a developer, so to speak, there are rules of vesting whereby if a developer takes steps to develop in accordance with an existing zoning ordinance, that developer's rights to the benefits of that ordinance are stabilized. That is, there's a point at which it's the law. Now, you might argue that that's too far down the road, that the developer has to make too many commitments in order for that vesting to occur. But there is, in fact, a mechanism in the law that recognizes that claim.
In fact, John, proffers in Virginia, the proffer that Chuck Rodkin might have offered, if accepted by the county, they do get their vesting, unless there's a major public...
And the proffer, I mean, if development is by right, there's no proffer necessary. And proffers are only occasioned when the developer wants to change something that would otherwise be applicable, a waiver or a rezoning or something like that.
Well, right? I haven't studied the law. I've just been down there and been told, what we need is something like this if you want to do that. Now maybe it's a volunteering thing, or
if you've
maybe
got
it's not
a,
really volunteering.
If you've got a by right development, there is really no leverage by which that can be extracted.
Well, that's the first line of defense.
Right.
The second line of defense is okay. What do I need to do here?
Right. I don't mean to avoid the fairness issue. To me, ultimately, the issue here is not an ideological debate about property rights. You will see people trot out different versions of property rights and use them in an argument. But in my sense, the ultimate issue in a lot of these debates is fairness. And the issue is there because the folks who are burdened are not the same group of people as the folks who are benefited. And typically the folks who are burdened are a smaller, more discreet, identifiable class of landowners, and the folks who are benefited are a much larger group of citizens, so that you are burdening a group, sometimes substantially, for the benefit of the larger good.
Well, and are you eliminating the possibility the small group could be doing harm?
Well, a small group may be doing harm. To me, the distinction between harm and benefit is incoherent. I mean, a harm avoided is a benefit, and a benefit secured is a harm avoided. You can characterize that either way you want, but the point is that there is an exchange going on. There's a redistribution of wealth, if you will, or of costs and benefits. And that's what gets people on edge. And the property owners that we saw at those hearings were the people who saw themselves as being largely burdened for the benefit of people throughout the county, including people in the growth areas that they considered not to have the same sort of stewardship history and so forth as they did. And there's a lot of parochialism in that and other things. But that the issue of fairness, I think, was front and center. So I think I liked Blake's image it's an oddly communitarian image. I loved it, of holding hands and marching into the future. Well, to hold hands, you got to begin to trust each other, and to trust each other, you got to be to indicate that you can understand each other's points of view and try to produce situations where that sense of unfairness is mitigated. There are devices to try to do this. Transferable development rights are one device whereby this can be done, so that you can regulate appropriately, limit use appropriately, protect the resources that you want to protect, and yet generate resources that can flow to those that are bearing particular burdens for that. In this state, so far at least, the legislation doesn't support a robust version of this, but I think it's to our advantage collectively within this jurisdiction and other jurisdictions to work on Richmond to give us more latitude to do this. And it's up to us to try to devise ways to do. I think that's the solution. To me, that's the solution to the rural areas problem, which we haven't reached yet.
Rich, hold on a minute.
Could I just ask Blake if he agrees with that? Okay. He's saying that he thinks that TDRs or some robust version of it could reduce some of the inequities that do necessarily occur when very few people own mountaintops, and we say we'd rather not have it all developed that way. But we can't do anything about the unfairness because Richmond, to use his terms, doesn't give us the authority to do it. Would you support it? If I supported it, would you go to Richmond to say that would be one way to mitigate it?
Well, the devil's always in the details. It depends. Sure, right. For example, it's as Jack likes to point out, there's so many developable lots in the county we don't need anymore. But when you actually go and try to find out that can I build there, or there's an ordinance, for example, that essentially says you can't build on 25% slope, seems eminently reasonable until you realize, well, that's the slope of a walkout basement. So am I really going against all walkout basements if it's 8 feet and 32? I don't want to. But there are other situations where you could say, well, that's on the side of a large slope. So I'm sure if John wrote it, I would look on it. Great.
Okay.
Let's ask John if he has a last question for either of your panelist colleagues, and then we'll open it up to the floor.
Well, I really don't have a question for my colleagues. I'd really like to hear from the... I have many questions for them, but I'd really like to hear from the folks who've spent their evening to be here.
Fire away. Anybody want to ask me a question? Tell us who you are, please.
I'm Brian Winterhalter. I'm a student here. Actually, a former student of British Collins and a former student of Professor Cannon also. My question is for you, Professor Collins. What would specific techniques to achieve ASAP goals look like? I've been hearing a lot of the concept, but I haven't been hearing specifically what you all advocate to get to where you want to go. And my follow-up question to that for Professor Cannon is, what is the impact of state law on some of those possible or likely techniques?
Could you repeat the
question? I can answer it. I think I can repeat the
question.
The first question, if I understand it, was directed to me, and it was, what is ASAP immediately and concretely trying to do to achieve some of these goals?
Right.
Jack, I think, maybe you weren't here, we are proposing that the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors, after advice from the Planning Commission, engage in a visioning process that would have, as part of the comprehensive plan,
a kind of a rate of population that would be our goal for development, and that would guide zoning, the amount of office space, industrial development, and also other things, including preserving rural land, that would kind of meet that sustainable optimum goal as developed through a process of analysis and democratic discussion and debate and adoption officially.
If I can ask a follow-up, then what tools are in place once you reach that point?
How would we know? I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
If you identify your optimal population size,
yes.
You have certain tools to manage how you get there in the way that you would like. What happens when you do get there? Presumably you would if there is such pressure.
Well, it would be like a population cap similar to an air emissions cap. The whole idea of caps, of saying that we've reached a sustainable level in endangered species or in air pollution or in stream pollution, saying now you can't go any further because the harm is unacceptable, then you have to either revise the ways you do the technology that throws this stuff into the river, up into the air, or in this case, you would not be stagnant or freezing. Quite the contrary. It would be a very dynamic process of people coming in and out and using different things. But also there would be, if the community, let's say, after a period of that population thought it was too little, they could go higher. I mean, there's nothing that would say, it's not an ironclad rule, it is a guiding document. And what would happen is that if they adopted it tomorrow, let's just say they did, then the planning staff would begin to immediately look at that factor, what it will do to the proposed population scale, as they do with slopes and area and infrastructure, and that it would serve to energize the planning staff to look at the kind of plan rather than to merely approve development.
Let me just add.
You had a question.
It's a legitimate question, and what we will probably do this coming winter is devote one of our evening sessions to the mechanisms available to us to achieve our goals. And they are essentially, let me tell you, nothing but the existing smart growth techniques. We don't have any magic bullet. But in addition to the range of smart growth mechanisms, we would add some sort of top limit for growth. And now the second part of your question was to John, asking if this is
Well, the effects of state law on your efforts.
Well, I won't offer a legal opinion since I haven't seen the exact proposal. But it seems to me if you're talking about a growth limit, even as a target, such that the limit would constrain the amount of development that you would allow. That has to be framed in terms of health, safety, and welfare. Okay. And it, as Blake mentioned before, it has to have a purpose that's not simply exclusionary. That is, it has to have a basis in the limitations that exist within the resource base of the county. And I don't know what those might be, but those would have to be determined and documented as a basis for whatever limits you would apply. And I think it would be difficult to maintain that those limits had to do with infrastructure that it was within the power of the county to develop or expand in order to accommodate. The fact that we just don't want to pay any more for roads probably doesn't support an ultimate growth cap on, and maybe that you pay that and so forth. So I think you need to look within the resource, within the natural resource base, and establish some rational basis, or you'd have to establish some rational basis that would support your determination that a particular limit was appropriate. I think you'd have to avoid it seeming as just a merely arbitrary preference on the part of folks here.
Is there another question? Yes, Joe, tell us who you are.
Yeah, I'm going to give a question. First, let me say that I'm not a member of Professor Collins' class. I just happen to be sitting on the table. I'm Joe Jones. I'm from Whitehall area in the county. I'm a current president of the County Farm Bureau and served on the Mountaintop Committee with John and others. And it's been very interesting to hear y'all. Before I get to that, John, I would say everyone here, the comments about TDR is very intriguing as far as the fairness issue goes. And me being one of those minority persons who was being mistreated by the current phasing and clustering proposed zones. So I would do whatever I could to help you in Richmond. And I think it would also to get a TDR program. And as you mentioned, Professor Collins, we've got to thank innovators, think of new things to help us reach your goals and our goals and community goals. And just like to say with your bundle of sticks, you keep saying property rights. There are many rights in that bundle. But let's just pick out one, which is the development right.
Yes.
Now, that one stick that's a development right,
right.
Don't think of it as I've been called a rich, greedy, wealth landowner. I guess I'm very fortunate. I do have property, but as far as being rich, I'm not. You think of that development right as Joe's savings account. When you want to take away the development rights from me, you're taking money out of my savings account. If you have a stock portfolio, if you have CDs in the bank, how much of that can you gift away or can the government regulate away from you before it is burdensome for future family?
Joe, would you be insulted if I ask you if I don't know how much land you got and I'm not interested in that, but I understand your concept and you're saying that Rich Collins may have a retirement pension and he might have stocks and bonds. I don't have any particular, but anyway, but yours is in the land that you farm and that you've owned, and that if we were to say that you couldn't develop it to the highest value that might be possible. Right in the market, that I'm going to put you in a personal situation that you couldn't sustain your life or have a decent life. Is that what your claim is? That you couldn't sell the land as a farm?
That's not exactly what I'm claiming. I don't know how much people think in terms of wealth, how much you have to have in order to live. If we didn't have to pay for medical insurance or pay taxes, I could kill deer and live fine.
Why don't you invite me out? I haven't got a good place to hunt this year.
But as far as the fairness issue goes, we talk of people moving in here from north of Washington or from California. They're moving here because they like the area and they think land's cheap. It is cheap for them. They come here and pay $40,000 an acre, and up there they're paying $200,000 an acre. So, yes, sure they want to move here. Come over here. The land is cheap. So they have taken advantage of the housing market value that's in their land. If I am deserving of that housing market value that's in my land, then anybody else is. As you said, the housing here in town is up 30-40%. Did you be asked to sell your land price it was 10 years ago?
Joe, let me ask this radical question in another way.
Me?
Yes. I've got
radical.
Let's say that I've got some farmland that's worth $100,000, and a bunch of nuts come in and say we're going to reduce the development potential, so that it's now I can only sell it for $75,000. Now, I've lost, because of government action, $25,000. The
That's
government
correct.
Hasn't come into your stock portfolio and dropped it by a quarter.
Correct.
Why should I suffer, or Joe, and not you with your stock portfolio?
Well, there are different... I guess the simple answer is, first of all, that it would not... We're not having some police come up and put a gun to your head. That if we downzoned, I guess what we're talking about here, or no... We're going to keep it in existing use. It's $100,000. Did you say the value was?
Yeah.
Okay. The $100,000, and you're using it, and you can, your return on that is only, let's say, 4%, and it would be 10% if you could sell a couple lots.
Answer the downzoning question. You downzone to rather than throwing in a bunch. Let's say you downzone the property.
Okay. All right. Okay. Then I would say, first of all,
He has five development rights.
Mm-hmm.
You downzone, so he has one.
And there's no TDRs. All right. Then I would say this, that there would be no question about it that you would be taking a hit, but not individually. There would have to be some rational basis for this, right? And that would be that there was a serious threat to some natural resource, to the quality of to other farmers, to your neighbors. And it would not be arbitrarily imposed, but would clearly be the result of political processes and deliberation and
so
a lot of opposition.
Shed.
And he still take the hit. And
as
John says,
he has a view shed. People want to look at his property because it stretches up the side of the mountain.
Well,
and so what you're saying is that we're going to downzone your property, but Joe, don't worry, we're going to downzone your neighbors too.
No, what I'm saying is that you should not do it unless there's a legitimate public community purpose that the community agrees to.
When is the benefit? How big is the
benefit? No, I'm saying that, well, again, John has said, if I understand it, there's a harm-benefit issue here. If it's only the view shed, right? I don't want to argue a marginal case, but that's normally what you guys do to people like me, is you try to take the most dramatic individual instance, a farmer that's always lived there, a decent guy, everybody loves him, and I never see an LLC coming out and say, the reason I want to keep this property in this form is because I can make a mint. I bought this stuff at a farm, and I plan to make $1 billion off it.
Well,
so my point is this. My point is that, yes, I would say that if it was proceeded, if we actually did that, nobody wants to be unfair to you. I don't. And I've always said, I do not.
Right.
No, the concept of fairness is not an easy one. But if, let's say, that everyone on mountaintops and everyone in wetlands was restricted to half of what they currently anticipate they could do, I would have to look at if as I understand it, the ecological and social consequences were as such as I understand them, I would say, unfortunately, that is the way it should be because the community comes ahead of your individual situation. I also have said I will do everything I can to go to Richmond to try to find a way in which you didn't take such a heavy hit by charging somebody that wants more development where we want it to pay you for some share of what you've lost.
Joe, it's a good question, and you put your finger right on a major ethical as well as legal issue, the conflict between the community good and the individual good.
Yeah, as far as cultural and family values go in this mix, like I said, I don't need the money, but I have four daughters. See, I'm trying to protect my family and my family's value and protecting the
But family. You mean by passing dollar value on to them, not subdividing the land, right? Or are you talking... I mean, I want to do everything for my kids, too, although I'm afraid I'm going to run out in a nursing home before they get much. But are you talking, therefore I'm asking you, are you just trying to conserve wealth so you can pass it to the next generation?
Does that matter?
Yes, it does. It does matter.
His intent for his property matters on how much you tax it?
No. What I'm saying, Blake,
if
is if he says that like, he
does
can't...
Does it make it easier for you to decide that you're going to leave it alone?
No, wait, it's not just me. Blake, we're talking about a process that would take years... You've already held up the Mountainside Ordinance collectively for 10 years. We haven't had a historic district for 20, and all because everybody wants to go slow. How slow do we have to go?
When your daughter's going to be getting married after they're 20, huh? So
No,
10 years. So he's already had the daughters when you downzone the property.
Well, just a minute, Blake. I don't think you're treating me fairly. What I'm asking was simply the question when he says he has four daughters and he's concerned about them because he himself is not likely to be deprived or you feel like you're going to live all right comfortably, if I understand you, right?
But I don't, no matter what your comfort is, should I be deprived of anybody?
Well, should anybody, I guess. I mean, I just wanted to know whether he's talking about subdividing so the kids could live with them or whether he's talking about having money.
Can I just make a point? I mean, this issue was sort of acute in the Mountaintop Protection Committee that Joe and I served on because Joe owns land on Pasture Fence Mountain, which is the view from my house down below. So I win if Joe's land is regulated. I get my view protected, and Joe loses. And the question is whether you can agree that is... Because there's so many more people down below Joe's Mountain looking up than there are on top of Joe's Mountain, you know, controlling that landscape, you can argue, well, there's a communal benefit, and that communal benefit, notwithstanding the cost to Joe, from the Mountaintop Protection Ordinance. But that doesn't That doesn't ease the fairness issue that Joe raises, and it's a significant issue, and it's one that has to be addressed directly. There are devices like TDRs that we talked about for mitigating it, and there are also ways to look at it. If it seems to me to make a difference whether this is the only ordinance that's going to be imposed, with mountaintop owners the only group that's going to be burdened, or whether this is part of a whole series of ordinances and management techniques that overall are going to, when you get through with it, are going to impose, on balance, roughly proportional burdens across the county, or at least in the rural areas, with corresponding roughly proportional benefits, so that at the end, somebody like Joe can say, well, I'm taking a big hit on this one, but if they do these other things, I'm going to come out ahead because my property is going to be of even greater value because of these other management techniques. Now, you may not be able to say that with the mountaintop ordinance. I hope the way we got it that you can say that. But that's one way of looking at it. And then there are these other devices that I think specifically try to address that and I think probably more reassuringly to property owners in Joe's situation. But that's an
important issue. Let's go on to, we have a question right here. But first let me say that it's my understanding the Mountain Overlay District Committee did not consider aesthetics as a reason to change zoning. Is that right?
Well, it had to be a factor, wouldn't it?
No, we did consider it.
Oh, it was.
We just didn't consider it alone.
I thought that we didn't make that.
No, we made the primary considerations, protection of soils and so forth. But I can't say that aesthetics weren't a consideration, and that's perfectly appropriate.
Tell us who you are, please.
Hi, I'm Lynn Weichert. I'm one of those Northerners that came down here and has retired here. But I was talking to Michael Moore the other day, and we came to a real agreement. And that is...
Michael Moore, the television guy?
No, I was just joking. Okay. the agreement was that there's an underlying assumption in the private sector that that you take risks. Just like the stock market, it goes up and down. You buy property, it goes up and down. And as the community, as a member of the community, I think the community tops an individual property right owner every time. I'm glad that Joe would like to make a lot of money. I hope he loses. Because the community, I think, if they had to vote on it, would like to keep the mountain the way it is. And that's too bad for Joe. But that's the private sector. There aren't any guarantees in the private sector. And I think that that's what we forget sometimes, is that you're not guaranteed because you buy property that somehow it's going to appreciate, you're going to make some money. It's not a guarantee. It's a risk, and you're taking that risk. And I think that's the same with the developer in the box site here in 29. He took a risk. Well, maybe we don't like his plan. And in my mind, the community has a right to say to that developer, sorry, we don't agree. You're in the private sector, you took that risk.
Well, I assume that question is to me and Mr. Rumsfeld. I think that's a position that's fair. I would say that if you announce that position and the state picked it up and said they're going to put a 250 bypass going through the western part of the county, that you would find yourselves suddenly up against a very vocal group that would say that you're absolutely wrong, that this community is going to be ruined if the state's purpose of improving transportation in the state is carried through. And that's why I started by saying, look, you need to have rules that are clear and they need to be fair. And the subtext is I think they need to be consistent. So if you say that the community always trumps the individual, which I don't agree with because I think there are benefits that sometimes aren't worth the cost, I think then you have to say, I am a supporter of the 250 bypass. And I would think that, you know, to wear that on one side of your T-shirt and ASAP on the other, that you may find yourself walking forward and backwards in a lot of situations.
Can we open it up for some other questions? I saw a hand up over here. Maybe I didn't. The back row, that was next one, then Blake.
My name is Andrew McCarthy, and if we decide that it's in the community's best interest to downzone somebody's property, then why is it not appropriate to characterize that as a taking and then therefore have the community, you know, if it is in the community's best interest, and they're receiving some benefit for that, then compensate them through taking. That would permit the thing which we see as a benefit, but it would require sort of him to be, you know, us to pay for some of that benefit.
Well, there is actually a state which has just adopted that principle. The state of Oregon adopted by referendum a law which requires that landowners be compensated for any diminution in value of their property due to a land use regulation. And the locality has the option of either paying the landowner for that diminution or withdrawing the regulation.
Now, if they acquired the property after the regulation.
Right. There's some rules about retroactivity and so forth, but that's basically the regulation. That's basically the rule that you put forth. Now, that's expensive. It is thought by the people in Oregon to be at least the folks that are for growth management in Oregon, to be destructive to the whole system that's there. But that is certainly one way of approaching it. And the argument is, if we really care enough about having this benefit, we should be willing to pay for it. We should be willing to muster the revenues to pay for it. It's not clear to me that governments operate in quite that same way, and that the ability to muster compensation is directly proportional to the amount of public benefits that may flow from a regulation. But if you accept that premise, then, you know, that's certainly a tenable view.
Blake, do you have any brief response to that?
No, I think that's, you know, that there is a... It's a very complicated thing. And it's certainly, if you own a gas station on a corner and they decide to widen the road, you're entitled to compensation. In fact, I knew of a guy who... started his gas station as soon as he found out they were going to widen the bridge and was able to double the value of his property. He's not a friend of mine necessarily. but I think there are some situations, but generally it's a case of, you know, really how much time you have to react to those sorts of things. For example, the Meadow Creek Parkway has been planned for, I don't know, 40 years. And some question is, as well, if they suddenly decide, if they then actually build it, you know, what right do they have to compensate the people who bought it 10 years ago, with full knowledge it was going to go through there for the diminution of their value? And I would say they don't have much obligation at all, because it was clear that the road was going to go through there. In general, I don't agree with this Oregon.
Could I just make one point? It seems to me, if you adopt that view, however, there's another side to it. And the other side is that regulations confer value as well as take it away. Mm-hmm. So if you were going to be consistent, you would not only be paying those who bore the burden, you'd be extracting the benefit. You'd be taking a payment from those who benefited. And that, I mean, if you really were serious about internalizing the costs, that's what you would do. And I don't think I think that's the political feasibility of that is just beyond my comprehension.
At some future point, I'd like to deal with this question of unfairness and structural unfairness, not just to the individual landlord. There's so much unfairness in the process of the public getting ripped off by making huge investments, doing many social things, and having the landowner take all the value, except for what he paid later in taxes. That is endemic to the planning process, and I think, Blake, one of the things that we're talking about with proffers is that we are now finding almost all states are saying that if you want to rezone your property upwards, you're going to pay a huge fee for doing that. And the assumption is, therefore, that the costs that had previously been borne by the public are now going to be borne by the property owner who previously had taken all that value, even though they didn't create it.
It's called impact fees.
Yeah, the unfairness is pervasive, and it isn't only to the individuals.
And they're not impact fees are not allowed in Virginia.
Probably.
So we have this little dance that Blake described before, that they're proffers, but often they are only a fraction of the real cost to the whole community. Blake, tell us who you are. And let's have one last question after this. And it's getting late.
So I guess in Oregon, as the culture changes, they're going to fly up against the theory of no new taxes, because it means they can't change the zoning, because it can't raise the taxes to pay for the change, which is an issue that could put us all. But really, one of the most vexing issues to me has been affordable housing. I heard many of you tonight talk about that. Only because of Mr. Fife here have we made any real progress in Charlottesville over the 25 years that I've been living here. But my question is that both sides of the argument, growth and certainly property rights, often use affordable housing as kind of a fulcrum point of the argument in both directions. And as much as I do not make a habit of stealing ideas from New Jersey, and I say that with the highest respect because I certainly wouldn't want to offend anybody from New Jersey.
you did.
It's a Jack Mason line. That's my source. So is that in Mount Laurel decisions 1 and 2, a certain, I guess, private property rights were stolen for certain classes of zoning or certain changes in zoning through a requirement of affordable housing, which they have TDRs of a sort, that they trade them back and forth.
They can actually purchase the one right. jurisdiction can purchase some from the other forth. Jurisdiction.
And since both sides kind of agree, I was wondering if all of you could comment on, and I know we'll never see this from the Great White Fathers in Richmond, but it's something to work for, is there a problem? Is there a true restriction on private property rights to demand, say, a 5 or 10% inclusion of affordable housing in certain classes of zonings, in particular rezonings?
Anybody want to start?
I always have an opinion, but I'm going to defer to the other.
Rich, give us a brief. Give us a brief opinion first, then we'll.
I believe that such an what you call inclusionary zoning, in which you're saying if you're going to build 100 units, 15 of them have to be available at affordable rates, is legal and can be done. There is some court decisions in Virginia that would argue against my view. I think the court would change it in light of existing circumstances. So I don't favor that particular proposal, by the way. I think there are better ways of doing it. But I would say that housing, just as Francis has reminded me every day at ASAP meetings, that we cannot resolve this growth issue unless we have an inclusionary element to find more housing, not just affordable housing, but housing for people who work who can never afford the affordable housing. So I believe that housing is the thing that we in ASAP have to couple tightly with our idea of having an optimum sustainable level with nature and cultural factors.
John?
Alamar County now has an affordable housing guideline of 15% for rezoned developments that requires a rezoning. So I can only say that that's legal.
Good answer.
You know, I've been an advocate of affordable housing for a long time. I believe in affordable housing. I'm not sure that really gets to it. Really what happens is you build an expensive subdivision, and the concept is, well, we're only going to allow you to do this if you give essentially a gift of 15% of your units to some lucky winner. And I'm not sure that results in a lot of affordable housing. It may result in, you know, that you're the kind of high, you're the designated poor person in the neighborhood, which may be a good idea. I actually think that really that if the it used to be in urban in European places that everybody lived together. It was more you had small houses and big houses. And one of the problems I think that happens in American planning, the reason I keep thinking that, you know, this is a Malthusian argument that we're sitting here with the same solutions talking 50 years ahead, that's not what's going to happen. What we have to do is change the models that we're working with. And one of the ones is, for example, is to allow much higher density. You know, as my father gets old, he doesn't need to have a house near me, but if I could put him in a house that's detached, smaller than my house close by, I think that would be helpful. You know, there are people who, you know, work as gardeners at Farmington. How come those guys can't have a separate house that's suitable for the people that work with them? But if you go to the county, they tell you if it's detached, then it can't fit on that lot, despite the fact the lot is huge. So it seems to me that they should have affordable housing in most subdivisions, but the kind of the way they're going to jam it down the goose's neck seems to me kind of the wrong way of feeding them.
Thanks. I'd like to point out that ASAP in its 4 years has had two focused meetings on affordable housing and growth. It is a major issue. We recognize that the high probability that if we try to limit growth, house prices will increase because of supply and demand, and the poor will be the first to get screwed. And how do we deal with that?
At our last meeting on this topic, an economist from UVA who focused on affordable housing argued that we shouldn't try to provide cheaper housing because it's hard in this market to keep them affordable, but we should simply provide better salaries. Very interesting argument. He just kind of shifted gears. Yes, tell us who you are, please. Last question.
My name is Jill Purnell, and I am also a new, very new, shiny new resident. The question I have is, it's perfectly all right to let people put it in development at any time, but when you have no recourse as a citizen for the damage that they cause, if they pollute my water, if they cause sewage runoff into my property, if the town has paid for them to come in, will the town then get money back from them to clean up the water and the sewer and the polluted air that they have created from that developer who put it in? If the town paid him, paid the landowner for the developer to come in, but how does a citizen have any recourse from that?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I don't have very good answers. There is a process up front, which I think is inadequate under our current arrangements, for trying to anticipate those costs and have the developer deal with them, either by making modifications to the development so it doesn't cause those problems, or in the case of increased traffic or other effects from development by having the developer make a contribution. In my view, that's appropriate because it forces the developer to internalize the cost that the developer is imposing on the community and therefore have the housing available at its full cost, not at some cost net of external costs that the developer is externalizing. We capture now only a very small fraction, of those costs. So up front, that process, in my view, is not fully effective. The back end costs are even more problematic. If you have an approved development that then causes damage that was unanticipated and not dealt with up front, the options you have basically are to enforce pollution control laws, which may not cover the damage, or to bring some sort of private action, which would be in the nature of a nuisance action. And nuisance actions are fairly limited. So I would say on both of those scores, there's probably not an adequate response to your concern.
Blake or Rich, do you want to...
No, I think John's answer. I think that the relationship between the law and economics and between the public and the private sector and the distribution and the necessary redistribution every time we make a change is one that is, I think, a very serious one. And this is the one the environmentalists have focused on. John uses, I don't know if he used the word externality, the spillover cost.
Yeah.
You did. I'm confident that if he did, he would have. This is what environmentalists have contributed more than anything else, is we start making him count all the numbers. Count all the costs, count all the benefits, not just those that you can put into your profit and loss statement. And that is the reason that the politics of growth and of the environment have gotten so volatile and so passionate, is because people feel a sense of unfairness on that end, just as unfairness happens maybe to Joe, in the sense that you don't want it, but in this case they're systemic and they're structural, and we've got to change them.
Blake, any...
Yeah, I guess really just an observation. There is a tremendous tendency to look at the builder and the developer as someone looks at maybe a narrow view of a scalpel, that it's the sharp edge that's really causing all the problems. But having been both those things, the costs go directly to the buyer. So the question is, as Rich would basically say, you should include all those costs, as many as we can find, and basically charge the developer who adds 15%. And
Blake, you know that isn't the case.
5%.
That's not the case.
And then passes it along to the home buyer. So the real question is how quickly do you want to see the prices go up by this all-inclusive treaty? Now, certainly, as you know, those people, you know, we talk about these hidden benefits, to the extent that you are an in-process developer or a builder and regulation goes up, that essentially widens the moat by which the industry is protected. So it's no surprise to find that builders in this area might make more money than someone in Greene County. If you can no longer, as it used to be when I started the business, where a pickup truck and a level and you were a builder. So it was very easy to get into, and the prices were comparably inexpensive. You could, builders sometimes did it, apparently after they're all done, for the joy of it. Now, there seems to be much more money in the deal, and that's largely because there are the maze of legal regulation, the costs associated with it, and the time involved are become so extensive that few people can come into the business, and the people that pay for that are not the builders. They are the people who come to the area. And so as you tighten down on those people, what happens is the people who, the patient, the people who buy the houses, pay for it. And so I don't have an answer about who's going to pay it back, but I can pretty well assure you that it will not be the builder.
I can tell you that it will be the builder or the landowner or both, and not all of it will be passed forward, and there's no economist in any department of the university, as conservative as they are, that would disagree with me on that point. His view is one that is promoted and promulgated, and it clearly doesn't make any economic sense. Some costs might be passed forward, some might be declining profits, some will go in lower land prices, and he knows that very well. He knows his game.
Sounds like we've got to have another meeting.
ASAP, from its beginning, Connie, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut it up. ASAP, from the beginning, has, while it's had an agenda, it's never pretended to have the answers. That's obvious tonight. But we do think that this kind of discussion can enrich the community dialogue about growth issues. And I couldn't be happier with the contributions that our three panelists made tonight.
Some pamphlets about ASAP.